From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT shop has it all. Browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Good morning. I'm actually live in New York City this morning, which is fantastic. So good afternoon, United Kingdom, and good evening to everyone in Australia and around the world. I'm Alan Miller. It's great to be back with TNT Radio today, and what a show we've got. Firstly, just to remind everyone that there is a big get-together tomorrow at 12 midday at Marble Arch for all of the campaigners around in and outside London and from across the country that are campaigning against the ultra-low emission zone expansion. Those that do not want to have limits and impositions made on them with spurious and actually complete false claims about deaths and ignoring consultations entirely undemocratic. So we're giving a big shout out to all of them there. And what a week it's been, a week where Jeremy Hunt is now blaming the Bank of England. We know that the technocrats only know a certain language of impositions and restrictions and limits and care little for ambition, development, innovation and transformation. They may give lip service to it sometimes, but we've seen with their actions speaking far louder than words. And certainly one of the concerns we've had it together when we're doing the cabinet and on this show we've been talking about is the lack of imagination when it comes to what we need to do in terms of growth, productivity, wealth creation for everyone. So in the first hour, I'm very pleased that we're going to be talking about a lot of these issues because I'm going to be with James Woodhuizen, who's going to be joining in just a second. And James is a physics graduate and a visiting professor of forecasting and innovation at the School of Engineering at London South Bank University. As well as being a broadcaster and an author of several books, he predicts future economics, technology and sociology of innovation, specializing in energy, IT, transport, and the office. He's an editor of Design Magazine and a founder of Blueprint, and he was later head of worldwide market intelligence at Philips Consumer Electronics Eindhoven in the Netherlands. James has written about North Sea oil for The Economist and is co-author of a really fantastic book that I would recommend, Energize, A Future for Energy Innovation. I'll put a link in at Alan Vibe. You'll be able to see it there. In making keynote speeches and consulting about energy, he's worked for Accenture, Arup, BDR, Geothermal Engineering Limited, and many others. You'll hear him in the news. He writes for Spiked, and I'm very pleased to give a warm welcome to James Woodhuizen. Thanks for joining us today, James.
Good afternoon.
So, I mean, just to start off, I suppose what I'd like to ask you, because when you write, you've kind of laid out some of the lack of imagination, ambition, and the problems with where we're at currently in terms of productivity, innovation, that kind of thing. But I suppose my question to you would be, why do you think it is that that might be the case at the moment? Because some people may look around and they think, well, we've got lots of stuff with big tech, and there always seems to be big buildings going up. If you look in London and some of the key cities, maybe not so much around the rest of the country, you know, financial services, there seems to be a lot of activity. Why is it that, you know, what's actually going on, James?
Well, you know, the fact of decline and lack of ambition and a blue funk, as it used to be called, that doesn't necessarily conflict with the Elon Musk's and, you know, the hopes in sending spacecraft to Mars and all the other things that we know. You know, it sounds contradictory. How can you be a bit critical of the innovation record, the productivity record, the mechanization record of the West? We need to distinguish between the West and China and Korea. You know, on the other hand, you know, for all your pessimism, James, I'm not pessimistic, in fact, you know, there are all these advances. You can look at the use of what is called artificial intelligence in cancer detection. You can look at a number of other clever things that we are doing, and there's no doubt we are, and we need a whole lot more of them. My critique is we're not getting a whole lot more of them, that regulators, cultural attitudes, identity politics, defense expenditure, and the blue funk with which I began, the kind of culture of fear in general about climate, about AI, many other things, that is impeding us and making the pace of innovation much slower than it could be.
You say that's very interesting. I mean, you say that military you put in there as well. I mean, just if we look at the 20th century, is it not the case that many of the innovations and the developments that we saw actually were a direct result of military investment, the kind of Cold War and that type of thing? Is it possible to have the kind of investment, the commitment to things, to development, expansion of our horizons on a material plane, or however you might frame it, without not going down that road of a huge military investment? Maybe you think it's a good idea as well, military investment. I'd be interested to hear what you think. But that's where so many different things came from, as well as the race to space, did it not?
Well, it did, Alan. But, you know, in military matters, as you'll be aware, it's important to fight the next war, not the last one. There's no doubt that, you know, the original space race was an offshoot of the Intercontinental Ballistic Missiles program. The integrated circuit from the late 50s as well was the product of America's efforts with the Department of Defense. So historically, you're right, defense has played a very important role in Britain and elsewhere, and obviously the United States, even with Wernher von Braun, the Nazi missile scientist. Defense has played a very important role in dynamizing innovation. I think if you go back to the war in Syria, there was a shot that I saw of the Russian war effort in Syria during the civil war of some years back. And they had all these Russian generals and colonels and so on, all in their green fatigues, looking like Shoigu or Gerasimov of fond memory. And there's about 100 of them in a room with laptops and screens. They're fighting the Syrian war for the Assad regime against ISIS and the West and a whole bundle of other people. And they're doing it with technology that actually comes from the civilian sector. So the last war, Alan, was about spin-off, you know, the from the military sector, that trivialized as the non-stick frying pan and overestimated by Mariana Mazzucato, the EU's favorite technology economist, who really believes that the iPhone grew out of, you know, the space race pretty much directly, and the space race from the defense effort. That's no longer the case. We don't have spin-off the way we used to. We have spin-on, which is where developments in the civilian sector, not least artificial intelligence, are actually leading the way for the military sector. Mobile phones, GPS, you name it. So, and drones as well. So, you know, we need to realize that a military expenditure is, you know, I fear to say, is a, pretty much a given with capitalist nation states. We need to watch it. And we need to take a balanced attitude toward it. It all, by the way, only some of it is on arms technology, which frequently goes wrong. A whole lot of it is on payroll, and a whole lot more of it is to maintain veterans quite properly. So, you know, arms technology itself, the most egregious example recently is the Ajax tank. It's cost £5.5 billion, and it's going nowhere because of vibration and sickness. Ordered by the wonderful Ministry of Defence in London, their procurement department, the subject of lots of internecine departmental strife over technology, supplied by General Dynamics, no surprise there, from America, and it doesn't work. And we've got no money for, you know, research and development, or to pay nurses proper money and to send Australian doctors back to Australia, where they're probably more needed. No, we got to blow £5.5 billion, quite a lot of money, actually, on a product that doesn't work. So that's the new agenda in military technology now.
It's fascinating.
You'll forgive the level of detail.
I love it. It's fascinating listening to your response. And I wonder what is really remarkable when I'm listening to you is the stark contrast with the type of discussions that we're seeing in Parliament and more broadly in society about what we might need, about what should be done at the level of policy, what politicians might do, but in the context of what the public needs, both in terms of the domestic sovereign requirement in the nation state, in terms of infrastructure or services. We've got all sorts of problems, haven't we, James? Like pollution being pumped into our rivers, like our public and private sectors, much of them being like with the public sector, much of it being not working efficiently, issues with millions waiting in the NHS. We've got infrastructure, lack of it. And yet, at the same time, there doesn't seem to be any really significant discussions. There's a lot of platitudes. And I'm mindful of thinking of Nick Clegg's point about if we waited to get nuclear energy, we'd be waiting till 2020 or 2022, I think he said, some years ago, and sort of scoffed at it as though it was a silly idea. And it's stark. Your overview just sort of puts into context the lack of these discussions in the public realm, pretty much. I mean, I'm wondering why, just, you know, you think this is more of a political question, really, but about these issues, why you think that might be the case?
Well, I've got to give you James's first law of artificial intelligence, which states that the more people rave about it and the more people are doom laden about it, the more likely they are to be humanities graduates who've never been near a soldering iron. So, you know, the conventional discussion on AI led by Tony Blair and William Hague, I had to laugh, in the Times just a couple of weeks back, I think. It you know, says everything you need to know about the state of public debate in Britain about science and technology. And you're very right to ask, you know, what is it that the public needs? What about river pollution? More recently, what about the delays, even in wiring up renewables to the national grid? And why is the, you know, discussion dominated, as you say, Alan, by platitudes? And that Nick Clegg example is terrific, a failure of long-term vision. And the fact is that in Britain, at least, you know, I can't speak for New York City, where it's better, and probably Oz is better as well. But in Britain, at least, nearly everybody who's got power in Parliament and elsewhere, in the BBC and in many of the corridors of power, has a degree at Oxford in politics, philosophy, and economics, PPE. And there's nothing wrong with that. But their ignorance of the history of science and technology, their ignorance of that simple point I made, that it's spin on, not spin off, with military technology. It's both ways, obviously, but the emphasis has changed. You know, they lack historical knowledge of all sorts, and especially about the history of science and technology. And that's because they've joined in the general war on the past, Alan. They believe that a whole lot of the past, especially the British past, is completely reprehensible. So they're not going to remember that the Spitfire, for example, let's not be nostalgic, that was produced 24 hours a day for 6 years over about 17 different, you know, specs, marks, as they were called. So they're not going to know something simple like that, which is what happens when you've not only got technology, but you've got the objective, the morale, the spirit of the times to try to deliver on the technology rather than employ failed politicians to talk about the prospects, the potential, and the dangers of AI. So let me give you an example, if I may, about what the public needs. I recently made the mistake of getting a washer dryer machine. I'm one of the 90% of the more, in fact, of the British public that has a washing machine. I had to get it replaced. It took calls to four separate suppliers, the insurers, Electrolux, Domestic and General, an old handyman friend, more than that, a brilliant plumber. And, you know, I'm still not done with it now. And I had a flood on the kitchen floor. These are what the academics call product service systems. The product is the white goods. The service system is everything on the phone, via the internet, through the courtesy calls, through the repetitions of my address, and all the rest of it that you and I all know from what used to be call centers and are now contact centers. It's quite hard if you're working from home, self-employed, not to lose a week's output from getting all of that stuff together and being able, you know, to wash your clothes. So that's only a middle-class man's, single man's predicament. But it shows, you know, that for all the promises, for all the glistening ad campaigns and everything else, we're more concerned about the trivial things in innovation than, you know, the real deal. We're more concerned perhaps about Apple's new headset, which will give finally, you know, some virtual reality experiences that might be worthwhile. We're more concerned with that, which is all very well, but there's millions of people all around Britain who have appliance failures every day, and it's not very nice, really. That's not to speak of the, you know, millions in aggregate that are flooded in Britain every day because we still use sandbags to fight against floods. So, you know, we need to be nittier, we need to be grittier, and we need exactly as you say to, you know, avoid the platitudes. You know, one of the two verbs I urge all your listeners to look out for, maybe it's only in Britain, not in Brisbane, and not in America, but unlock and unleash. There's another couple also, which is ramp up and roll out. As soon as you hear about unlocking innovation, unleashing the power of innovation, you know that the person talking about it knows nothing about what a hot soldering iron is like to work with, knows nothing about how difficult it is to make the digital realm work, how many pitfalls there are in all of that, how much hard brain power it takes. So when we hear unlock and unleash, that's the moment to be on your guard. Your listeners should watch out for it. And in while we're doing the nitty and gritty, just to conclude,
Be on our guard. I've got to get a quick break in, James. So I'd say who's got the concerns of those nightmare phone calls where you keep having to repeat your address and get called off sometimes. I'm here with James Woodison. It's Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. Join us just after this break.
Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres. This is a man who was the former president of Socialist International. Let's repeat that. How many of you knew that out in the audience? The United Nations Secretary General is the former president of Socialist International. Did anyone know that? This is the guy that makes pronouncements about the climate and how we have to destroy the capitalism and emissions and free markets and private property because the climate demands it. Gee, you think he had a bias going into the job that was his position? They never mentioned that. In fact, the only time I saw it mentioned was by Daily Caller when he first assumed the position about 4 or 5 years ago. But just to give you an idea, that's where he's coming from. So his whole view of this is how we can collectivize, nationalize, centralize, and get rid of any market forces in any involvement in our economy, in our energy sector, and also national sovereignty. He sees this all as one big global problem that everyone has to essentially give up their rights to deal with.
The Mark Morano Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Have you ever felt like time was moving too fast? Do you need a break from the hustle and bustle of your daily routine? Then come and experience Sam Sam Yao Noi, where time slows down and magic comes to life on the stunning Yao Noi Island in southern Thailand. Our private villas and public spaces are quiet, spacious, and very inspirational. Inside and outside magic spaces, you'll find exceptional facilities and a full contemporary art collection to inspire your senses. Our dedicated Sam Sam family is here to provide bespoke services to make your stay unforgettable. Let nature and our SamSam family team take over, and you'll get the utmost recalibration of your mental balance. Discover the enchantment that awaits you at SamSam Yanoi. Book your stay today at SamSam Yanoi and experience our magic places, magic spaces for yourself.
Book your stay in Thailand now and visit samsam-spaces.com.
Weekends with Alan Miller on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Sorry to cut you just a little short there, James. If you do you want to finish that thought on, you were just explaining.
Yeah, I referred to these. Forgive me. Well, I referred to the war on the past. It's a general war, but it means that people in high places are astonishingly ignorant of the history of science and technology and how it's worked. Right? But they also very much fear the future. And that's one of the reasons that they try to indulge the youth all the time. So if you fear the future, Alan, and you're always convinced that mankind's going to do wrong and mess everything up, not you, but mankind, if you fear the future, you're not going to have a long-term vision. You're going to make crass remarks like Nick Clegg and the Liberal Democrats always do, which is, you know, oh yeah, fusion power, it's always 30 years away, and all of these things. And that's no longer true, I don't believe. And it's this kind of long-term forecasting, which the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change does for 2050, 2100, what's going to happen by then. You know, none of those really amount to long-term vision. None of them challenge the conventional wisdom. All of them are based on a few computer models and a twist of algebra thrown in. And it's just not good enough. We need a more profound discussion. I'm very grateful to you and your channel for entertaining it.
You, in your book, Energize, which was over 10 years ago now, but you were at the cusp of explaining many things. But, you know, what you call the lack of an ability to deliver an intelligent response. And you talk also about net zero, or the question of climate change and how we orientate ourselves around all of that. I suppose the question, you know, when my son's about to go to university, when he first started at school, so that's the period of time, let's say like 14 years he's been in since primary school and secondary school, he, from the very, very get-go, started saying things like, "Dad, I don't like cars." I'd say, "Why is that?" He says, "Because they're drowning us." And it was almost like a new secular religion that was being taught in schools, that we are just drowning and polluting and killing ourselves and the planet. And that it seems that net zero, if you ask people in the abstract, would you like to protect the planet? Many people say yes, that it's a popular idea. But then when it comes down to the specifics, what it means, then people get much more concerned. Obviously, it hits them in the pocket, but also things like power cuts that we've seen warnings of this year in the United Kingdom. There have been some that have attempted to say, well, you know, the Conservatives said, well, we're going to start now having smaller nuclear generators that we can develop and things like that. But what in your view needs to be the approach a society wide at the level of, you know, maybe education, but at the level of what it means to have a innovation and development that's kind of can really is, you know, what they call fit for purpose. They're always using that term as well, but, you know, that could really meet our needs and more for a future orientated kind of idea.
Well, I think one way you could do this, Alan, is by addressing, it's always a good idea to interrogate different categories of thought, you know, buzzwords and things like that. I don't mean unlock and unleash on this occasion. That doesn't mean anything. But if you take the idea of the energy transition, what does that mean? The energy transition. Apparently, we are in an energy transition. And it's true what you say. It's very worrying. A generation of children has been taught by foolish teachers that our salvation and the direction and the end goal of the energy transition is a renewables-based Britain with a bit of nuclear thrown in. And Keir Starmer believes that you will get a gas-free Britain. This is his energy transition. No more gas-powered electricity generation. It will all be a renewable and nuclear in 7 years' time. And we see from that a desire to close not just coal fired power stations, which have had to come back in action in Britain as in Germany and elsewhere, given the energy crisis. But we want to ban fracking, stop any coal burning, and no new licenses in the North Sea, end gas-fired power generation in 7 years' time. That's a hell of a transition. Even Ed Miliband has admitted as much. It's not going to happen. The energy transition around the world is such that between 2000 and 2020, roughly, the proportion of the world's energy that was based on gas fell from something like 86% to 83%, give or take a percent or two. So there's a transition going on, maybe, but it's going very, very slowly. And in Africa, if you go to Senegal, you go to Nigeria, they want more fossil fuels. They're making the point, hooray, finally, that there's no chance they can industrialize on the basis of renewables. Nevertheless, a generation in Britain and in America and in Australia has been brought up to believe that just because on a sunny, windy day, 40 or 60% of our electricity generation in Britain is powered by renewables, that will also get us through somehow, presumably with nuclear and also with storage, those days when there isn't any wind and any sun. And therefore, what we need to do is start a long and slow struggle to clarify what the energy transition is, what the basic numbers are, what is pie in the sky, and what is realistic. And once you begin to do that, none of that is to quarrel with the mainstream narrative that there is climate change, that some of it is man-made, and we ought to do something about it. But one must get every problem in science and technology in perspective. Science can tell us about the climate change, has nothing to tell us about what to do about it. And in my judgment, climate change is not the immediate threat that power cuts via renewables and a rubber band grid system are to millions around the world, beginning with the emerging world, but also even in the advanced capitalist economies. So, you know, we it's a long process of education that we need to embark on, and we can't look to Keir Starmer, the United Nations, the International Energy Agency, or free marketeers to believe that we'll get the right solutions. We need something a bit deeper than all of that.
We'll talk about that a bit more. But one of the things we're seeing whilst you're saying that, you know, we need a slow and sort of exacting critique and, you know, alternative, is that, for instance, in across Britain, we've got local authorities and the central government who've been funding road closures, calling them low traffic neighbourhoods. We've got impacts that have surveillance around driving with low emission zones, they call them, that's now sort of doing them across Scotland in all the key cities. We've got ULEZ in London and an attempt to expand it outwards. We've got a clean air zone in the Midlands, and lots of zones called different things, different types of zones all over the UK, and 15 to 20 minute neighbourhoods, which sound that they could be good if they actually provided services, but actually amount to banning people from driving and fining and imposing things on them. So, but we have seen many people challenging these things, and we've seen people from across the political spectrum, actually. It's interesting that in London, sort of Labour MPs, and we've got the head of the GMB union talking about net zero and the impacts to jobs and working people. And that's true that, you know, some of the work we found that together with people we're working with around the country who are challenging some of these impositions. But those things are happening fast, and they are, they're fairly well financed, even though it should be noted that people challenging it have stopped the government actually continuing the livable streets, active travel funding for bikes in certain places, for transforming roads into bike lanes, which is a very good thing in my opinion. But how do you see this thing about, like, you know, critique and challenging things, and then also the public actually getting involved, taking action, challenging things? How do you see that relationship?
Well, transport is a very, very useful example, Alan. I'm glad you raised it. In transport, you know, nearly everybody is an expert. That's the first thing you can say about it. We've all had to go through it. We all want to move around. It's essential to freedom, and freedom is essential to the human race. So we've all got opinions about it. I think that's always been true, but what's new is what you point to, which is the war on the car. We've got the war on the past, in terms of hating it and having no plan for the future and being amnesiac about science and technology. We've also got the war on the car, and indeed it's a war on transport altogether, because nobody can say that public transport, buses, trains and so on, are making up for the difficulty of parking, of avoiding fines, of avoiding the difficulty of avoiding road closures and all the rest of it. There's no compensating mechanism. And the fact that they are always worrying so much about electric cars being a burden on the grid and not being road taxed and so on, and that Extinction Rebellion in Britain doesn't want electric cars because it just doesn't want cars, all of that shows that the restriction on mobility that we, so many of us, endured during the COVID lockdowns is something that the bourgeoisie and the elite take very seriously now, and they want more of it. They want to restrict our mobility. And all of that will be under the slogans that you yourself adduce critically enough, Alan: active travel, you know, walking and cycling, you know, better for pollution, better for fitness and personal longevity, and all of these things. And what it neglects is something very simple, right? This is how primitive the discussion is, really, which is an electric car, which is held out as the salvation, usually by the rich, for the rich. That's why always they're complaining about lack of chargers, as if that was a problem that concerned you and me. An electric car consists of metal, steel, rubber, plastics. Where does that come from? And the answer is fossil fuels. If you don't have gas, you don't have intense heat, you cannot have a plastics, steel, and indeed even a textile industry. You can't do those things. So an electric car may have an electric battery. We could talk about them. But it's still reliant on something that's the opposite of the energy transition, still reliant on fossil fuels. So got to suspect the motives of people who advance electrification as the solution to climate change, done by little old us setting an example to the world. I'm sure the Australians listening have had quite enough of the bombs setting an example to the world. The second thing you can say, if you want me to say it, is that you can sell a lot of electric cars out of the showrooms. You've still got 35 million cars in Britain on the roads. So I believe they sold 700,000 electric cars, including hybrids, last year in Britain. It's a lot, and no doubt it'll hit a million one of these days, because we've got a booming economy here in Britain, and everything's going swimmingly. And that means that it's all going to go electric. The fleet is going to go electric, not the showrooms, the fleet, not the internet sales, the fleet on the roads. You've got to do a million a year for 35 years before you replace that fleet. And that's before you start thinking about the 8 million used cars that are sold every year in Britain. It's now down to 6 million. So the energy transition with electric cars is not going to happen anytime soon. Sales is not the same as the stock or the installed base or the vehicle fleet on Britain's roads. It's the same in the States, same in Oz. It's not a question of market share in the sales room. It's a question of how long all of this is going to take. And the only conclusion you can draw from all of this is that the whole thing is ridiculous. And we're going to have petrol and diesel driven cars for a long, long time. And the electric car is largely a stalking horse for stopping us moving around long distance and even short distance. And the bans on cars are discriminatory, hostile to disabled people, to women in particular, to mothers, to babies, to old people, you name it. They are discriminatory. I'm not going to get behind that.
That's a really good time to take a short break. When we get back, we're going to talk about a bit more of the consequences of all this and some more of James's thoughts on it. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with James Woodhuizen. This is TNT Radio. Join us just after this.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
The Ocean Gate submersible saga has reached its sad but expected outcome. No survivors aboard. It is believed that the submersible suffered a catastrophic failure, which led to its immediate implosion, as the pressure at that depth is 400 times that at sea level. Perhaps the only lesson to be drawn from this episode is that when you go woke, you might end up a lot more than broke. What am I talking about? Well, Stockton Rush, the founder and CEO of Ocean Gate Expeditions, is on record as saying he didn't want to hire former military submariners because 50-year-old white guys aren't inspiring enough. So he wanted to hire a diverse, younger staff. In retrospect, he might wish that he'd hire those 50-year-old white guys that are former military submariners. Just saying. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
I came to clean and noticed there was no food in the house.
She told me her sister just forgot to pay a few bills.
He was in for his monthly trim. When I noticed the bruising.
Is there anything I can do?
Thousands of older Australians experience elder abuse every year. If you're concerned about someone you know, you don't need to have all the answers. Call 1-800-ELDER-HELP for free confidential information and support.
Alan Miller on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
When you talk about just how superficial and silly some of the claims are, and that surely it's, well, my question to you is, why do you think it's not made more clear more often by more people? Why is there an emperor's clothes situation? Or maybe there's not, maybe ordinary people are just like, they see through all of this. But why is it that with all this brouhaha about electric cars and about new styles of living, whatever it might be, why is there not more robust critique and an ability just to say, this is just silly. Look, these are the reasons why, as you've just done, you can't get rid of fossil fuels even whilst you're doing this. You're just making this up, this stuff. It's not actually rational at all. Why is that not happening, in your opinion?
Well, Alan, I think it is happening a bit. I mean, we mustn't overestimate it. And I'm sure you and together and the people who have achieved some successes in overturning a local traffic network, low traffic network here, and you know, a prejudice there, that's different from 5, 7, maybe even 2 or 3 years ago. There is a bit of pushback. It's not a lot, but there are a lot of disabused Tories out there. There are a lot of people who have often gone down a rabbit hole, but are not satisfied with the performance that Britain and other nations did over COVID. There is much less legitimacy for governments nowadays. And I think we'd have a clearer discussion if people on the right were not so glib as people on the left are. You know, both sides are often extremely glib about energy, about free markets, and all of these things. Now, you raise a very important point, which is, Sir Keir Starmer in Britain wants to close down a lot of gas. There's 150,000, maybe 200,000 jobs at stake there. He's ruffled the feathers of the unions for what they're worth. And you've got to ask, why is he doing this? Why do they want to close down transport a fair bit. They want to close down the gas industry a fair bit. They're in their remarks about, you know, how a man can be a woman and the prevalence of teaching primary school children about all of that. They seem to want to close down education and the conventional family. So why are they doing that? I think you can say that apart from their ignorance of science and technology and of history and so on, you know, they seem ignorant of the fact, just to deal with the trans issue, that we have 8 billion chromosomes, cells in our bodies, each one of us, and they're all coded by chromosomes with XX and XY. There's 8 billion pieces of evidence what biological sex you are in any body. The body also consists, 18% of it is carbon, that terrible element that we're all against, right? 18%. So there are all of these sort of very basic things that we don't hear enough of, the right isn't very good on. And the reason that Keir Starmer and others will continue in the view that black can be white and white can be black, they're trying to appeal to the youth, to your son and other people who grow up dismayed by the decay around them and the malevolence they find towards human beings and toward nature. They're trying to impress the United Nations and the global community, as it's called. Keir Starmer said, which did he prefer, Davos, the World Economic Forum shindig that they have in January in Switzerland, or Westminster in London? He immediately replied, Davos. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I think the World Economic Forum is a joke. And Klaus, the man who heads it, even more of a joke. But it says a lot that you're trying to impress your UN friends, your WEF friends, the OECD, the IMF, the International Energy Agency. That's his audience. Apart from the domestic middle classes, the youth, university towns, the civil service, the professions. So it's, you know, and I think the origin of most of this stuff, this kind of condescending attitude to real debate and real knowledge about, basic knowledge about science and technology, all comes from the Democratic Party in the United States, mostly the Identity Politics, AOC, Democratic Socialist Alliance, if I have the name right, it sounds so boring, DSA in the Democratic Party. All of these ideas about climate and the need for more regulation, the need for a slowdown, the need to destroy industries and stop growth, all comes from there. And their subservience to Hollywood and their desire to indulge the youth is something that Labour politicians really do need to be called out on. It's not, I'm not inventing this. Rachel Reeves, who's supplanted others in the Labour Party apparatus as being number two to Keir Starmer, she explicitly models her ridiculous energy policy on Joe Biden's IRA, Inflation Reduction Act. Yeah, right. She made that quite explicit. They've got no new ideas, such as they have come from a few think tanks on the east and west coasts of the United States.
I mean, so I want to, it turns me to one of the things you said, and when you in your response to why more people are not just spelling out how silly some of these things are, and you'd said there needs to be better arguments on that, whatever the right might be, challenging with the left as well, not being as crass. But I suppose my question is this, because you also made some points about the market and other things, is that it does strike me that there were the big debates used to be around the economy, around organising it and around our relationship to the public and winning them over. And that's gone away in the way you really explained very well, in that kind of technocratic managerialism and Keir wanting to talk to, like many others, like Rishi and others, they prefer to talk to people internationally than their own than citizens. But when you look at things like the WPA, the New Deal, Franklin, the Roosevelt. Obviously, there were big clashes and debates about that between the older Republicans and Democrats of a different period, and the arguments about what, you know, a bit like Keynes versus Adam Smith or Hayek. But, you know, I suppose the question is, from your thinking on this, how would you, you know, you're obviously trying all the time to this, you're doing it, you're writing about it, you're talking about it publicly, you're a commentator, you're thinking about it, but to popularize the idea that we can engage the public in a kind of new, in a plan, people talk a lot about plans, but there's that lack of planning, it seems, that engages the public, has their view, gets them to sign up to it, and win them over to saying this is what we need. I mean, the WPA with house building or roads, and obviously there were various reasons for all of that, but it had an impact. You know, the Manhattan Project had an impact where you pooled resources and research. And it seems that the potential for both private enterprise, but also the ability for us to shape things and using the state in some capacity. I know many people get very nervous about all of that, but really it seems that that's more of a reflection of people's concerns about humans, if we can trust ourselves to shape things and to do things. And it seems that that engaging the public in all of that and insisting that, you know, what we need and what we want to see, and, you know, a few more manifestos, maybe a bit, whether it's the kind of futurist of the past or a new type of Bauhaus movement or whatever it might be, but something that can captivate the imagination. Can those things just come along, James? Can people just assert them, or how do you see all of that?
Well, you know, you mentioned I write for Spiked, and every so often they kindly ask me, would I do another article on heat pumps, and, you know, or sewage, which you mentioned. And, you know, I rue the day a little bit, but at the same time, I know that if there's one thing I write about, in England at least, that gets a Twitter discussion going, it's only Twitter, it's heat pumps and sewage. Now, that wasn't true, you know, some years back, that you could count on scores of people, hundreds of people, sometimes tens of thousands of people discussing, you know, what a load of rubbish policy and practice was around heat pumps. And the same with our friends at Ofwat or Oftwat, the Office for Water Regulation, and the sewage, I mean, the water companies. So, you know, like I say, there is a bit of a pushback. There is more discussion. Electric cars are a big talking point, and their merits and demerits. So I do think I've published a few manifestos myself, and one of them is called Big Potatoes, a bit like the Energize book. It stands up pretty well over the years as a forecast and as a call to arms. I think it's great events and individuals who will form what will eventually be a movement for something better than common sense, because common sense would suggest that the sun rises each morning. It doesn't. The earth turns. We need something better than common sense, but we need a whole lot more common sense than current politicians. I think a movement will evolve. If you're talking about impact, I mean, to stop the boiler scheme, which has got 14,000 heat pumps established over the whole of the British population the last time I looked, to stop that and to discuss why that is wise, why we should hang on to gas boilers, how, in fact, you know, going back to my washing machine example, how it's so hard to control your central heating for lots of people to you know, to get the most out of it, not to have your radiators bunged up, all the rest of it. There's all sorts of things that are actually real that politicians don't want to discuss, and some of them are worthy of manifestos, quite a lot are not. Could the state do more? I think with the right discussion, with an energized population, that's why the book I wrote is called Energize. It's a verb, it's not a noun. It's not just about energy. It's energizing the population so that popular sovereignty is wielded in relation to choice of technique, choice of energy source, and so on. Whether we really want cobalt mined by hand by children in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So democratic. We want that kind of labor going into our wonderful electric cars. That's the discussion we need. It is worthy of state intervention, sometimes to regulate for safety's sake, but most of the time to get out of the way of genuine innovation, whether it's done by the state or the private sector. We don't have enough of that. I mean, has anybody ever seen, of your listeners, a robot on the street? Have you seen a robot take somebody's job? You know, like a cashier in a supermarket, walk up to the cash desk and move the person out and take their job? No, we haven't seen any of that, thank God. But I mean, before we believe that AI and the robots are coming, you know, we might ask, you know, what is it that makes technology replace human beings? It's usually employers rather than technology. So that's the kind of, you know, very basic but mature discussion we need before we decide to spend billions automating, robotizing, mechanizing, whatever it is. I'm all in favor of that. But I'd like you and me, rather than some lazy civil servant working from home, to decide, you know, what our priorities should be. That's the issue in front of us. And people will rally around that discussion. That's human nature.
So you also have mentioned, and you talk a lot about Africa, what's happening in Asia. We know that in China and India, we're seeing some very bold leaps forward. We've seen a transformation of the living conditions and length of life, and the cities, you know, like Beijing, just expanding enormously. How do you see the relationship between what's going on in the East and not to kind of, you know, well, how do you see the relationship between what's going on in the East and parts of the Middle East as well, and what they were calling the BRIC countries, the new sort of perhaps leaders, and what's happening with countries like America, Australia, Britain, what the English speaking languages may be effectively, how do you see that playing out over this next period in terms of technology and innovation and what that means politically? I know it's a big question, but a few thoughts on that, if you would.
Well, I think the most important thing about China is that the scale of dissent is underestimated. And therefore, you know, the always onward and upward trajectory of the Chinese Communist Party with 90 million members, you know, is by no means a given. If you look at the strike maps in China that I've tweeted about, if you look at the treatment of minorities, if you look at tensions east and west, north and south, if you look at student discussion and a resistance to property seizures by the Chinese Communist Party, you know, there's a lot more resistance actually in China to the regime and to its plans, including technology and the emphasis on property and debt. A lot more resistance there than arguably there is in Russia the morning after Prigozhin has been on the rampage. So I think the East doesn't have hold all the cards. I think another thing that's underestimated is Korea, South Korea, and the revival of Japan as well. I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about both of them in the next few years, including their technologies. I think very big mistake to underestimate Japan and Korea. That's something that's being done in the West, not taken very seriously. So I do think the future of innovation is very much bound up with the East. You cannot reduce technology to tech and tech to Silicon Valley and the West Coast. You know, electrons don't do everything. Chemistry, energy, steel, mining, farming, pharmaceuticals, they do a whole lot as well. That's the subject of innovation. And in many of those fields, you know, America is still very strong. Even some bits of European corporate life are strong. But broadly, the prospect is Asian. At the same time, we understand, don't we, that conflicts between Asian powers are historically very damaging, have been, and are likely to be that, most obviously around Taiwan in the coming period. And I think there's something worth saying, which is the wager that Putin and Xi Jinping have made on fossil fuels from Russia supplying China, and China sending back consumer goods and probably capital goods as well to Russia. We might hate the regimes. I do hate the regimes. But I think the bet on fossil fuels that they're making, from everything I've said, is not entirely foolish. Just 2 years back, 3 years back, The Economist newspaper.
James, I've got to pause you there because we're going to go to the news. Okay. But I really hope we can get you back. You've been brilliant. Thank you so much. People can see James at James Woodhyzen. Have a look at Alan Vibe. I'll see you after the news.